Hi, I'm your host, Dominique, for the blog Music Art Culture. Thank you for listening. Today's episode is all about, well, writing. Yep. Episode 15, we talk with Brandon Alexander on poetry, publishing, and creative ownership. So make sure you head over to our social media page on Twitter at MACEF Public Arts to join the conversation. And don't forget, we're also on Instagram at Music Art Culture. We've been sure to tag our special guest today, Brandon Alexander, and I want you to be encouraged to check out his new book, The Winter's Cactus. You can do that online, thewinterscactus.com, where you can check out some of his material there, and you can also follow him on social media as well. Today we get into what the Board House Publishing founder thinks are the top three skills of a top-notch writer, which I'll tell you now: passion, pleasure, and purpose. However, it didn't stop there. And if you keep listening, you'll come to know what I found out, which is why this guy is going to be on your need-to-know list. Keep listening. So I am very thankful that you allowed me to interview you for this episode of the blog Music Art Culture. And I just wanted to share a little bit about your background with our listening audience. So it's amazing that, for one, you're a publisher, correct?
Yes.
Are the founder of Board House.
Most definitely.
And you all are located in Queens, New York.
Yes, yes, Queens, New York.
Very cool. So let's just start there. I mean, let's dive into this. Where do you consider to be your hometown and your city? Are you from New York originally, or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say Queens is definitely my hometown. Most of my family's from Trinidad, so I would say that's, you know, it's a close tie. Depends on what day it is. I might say Trinidad. Okay. I might say Jamaica, Queens, you know, so.
All right. So do you eat a lot of Caribbean food, or
all the time?
What does it look like?
A lot of curry chicken, a lot of roti, some doubles on a Sunday morning.
Very nice. All right. So yeah, clearly, yeah. Thanksgiving was wonderful for you.
It was incredible. How was yours?
It was great, actually. It was great. I didn't have to do any cooking. I might have to get some recipes from you when it comes to that curry chicken.
Oh, please do. I got you.
Yes, we'll save that for another conversation. But let's dive into this. So what junior high did you go to? What high school did you go to?
Oh, man, let's take it back. Okay, so for junior high, I went to Allen Christian School. So I went to a private school in Jamaica, Queens, not too far from where I live. And that school is really good. Supported by the community and everything like that. And then for high school, I transitioned. I actually went to a boarding school type program. I went to, you know, high school out in Connecticut, in Glastonbury, Connecticut.
Wow.
As a part of this academic program called the A Better Chance Program. So pretty much they, you know, source gifted students from the inner cities and place them in schools and better socioeconomic environments, hence A Better Chance.
Okay, so the school in Connecticut, was that more of a public school, a private school? Did you go from a public school in junior high to a private school? What was that like?
Yeah, so I went from a private school to a public school, which was the high school. So the actual high school was a actual public school within the community. And the Better Chance program actually had kind of like a house or a dorm where the students in the program would stay and attend school.
Wow. So that allowed you to really have some time to focus, hone in without distractions on whatever was getting as far as the subject matter, getting into your grades and learning. Do you think that had a more seasoned effect on your productivity and your success?
I would say, you know, I feel like I would be, you know, successful wherever I was. I had always been in the gifted programs in the public school system in New York, but I would say kind of like the environment. That can definitely be a distraction. It can, you know, have forces that really kind of pull you in one way or another. So I would say, you know, being in the suburbs in Glastonbury, that kind of gave me a buffer zone to really expand and do things and just take a deep breath, you know, without having to look over my shoulder every, you know, 5 seconds.
Okay. I feel that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, definitely.
What was your favorite subject in school?
Man, I would say between history and poetry. So just was always really creative. I was really good with dates, and I would just love history. So I studied, everything from U.S. history to, German history, Greek mythology, everything.
Wow.
And in poetry was just, my teacher was really, really beautiful. So that helped. But
okay.
But I was always a poet, and so that class came naturally to me as well.
All right. Well, that's really, so you were really into philosophy, but you said you were really good at dates. How did you determine that early on? What did that look like?
I don't know. It was just, I guess, memorization. I was really good at memorizing the dates and just events that happened in the past. I would say so, yeah.
That's a good trait, actually. It's like you're never lost. You never forget anything. That's actually a really good trait. And I guess it ties into that creative expression when it comes to writing, because it helps you to really envision like an image, and then that you are able to transcribe into something that you share with your readers. Is that how you paint pictures? Is that a part of your process, or?
I didn't kind of link those two worlds together. But that is how it happens. There has to be some sort of a movie that has to be created in my head first, and then I kind of, translate it into words, into poetry. And so that is actually how it happens. It's all a movie in my head. Yeah.
All right. So what were some of the memorable moments in school and during those early development years that kind of shaped your life?
Early develop, I would say kind of like the memorable moments would be in high school, definitely the we had a talent show, and I think I was rapping with like two of my other friends, and that was like one of the largest stages I had been on to date, right? Mm-hmm. Even growing up, like elementary school, middle school, I had always been on stage, but never in front of that many people. And so there were like over 2,000 kids in my high school, so
wow,
it was kind of like a small college. So to be on a stage in front of that many people, doing what I love, that was kind of like the defining moment where it's like, okay, I think I like this, and they definitely love it. So let's take it further.
All right. So, wow. So definitely you're not afraid of crowds. You got that out of the gate, you're not afraid to be an orator and speak. And I think that's a very powerful thing to share. Because that is a part of the process, allowing yourself to be open, be heard, be seen. And you put two and two together at a really early age in your development where you said, hey, you know what? I want to share myself, and I will allow myself to be seen and heard and open myself up to wherever that takes me, because that's really kind of brave. So it's amazing to me when I speak to people and they develop that fearlessness when it comes to interacting with large crowds, it definitely says a lot. And it's a great stepping stool to prepare for public speaking, which essentially is what you're all about when it comes to being an author, when it comes to setting up being a founder as your own publishing house. You're definitely always connecting with people. So how would you say you've been able to deal with that?
With public speaking, I think it's something I've always loved. And I know a lot of people, it's kind of one of those number one fears, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like public speaking, like people would rather like die than, speak publicly. But I think for me, it was just the microphone. At a really young age, it was just like, I loved hearing my voice on the microphone. And that sounds kind of, self-centered a little bit, but it's more so just like how it actually happens. Like, how does the microphone work? And, oh, I can hear my voice coming through the speakers. Like, it was just really exciting. I always loved music. And so, right, the closest thing to music is pretty much like a microphone. And so I just took that, ever since I was young and translated it over. And I think connecting with people it's really easy. It's mutual attraction. They have something I want, I want to help them. They can help me possibly. So it's always, great to connect with people. The public speaking aspect has just always been there. Like I said, I've always been on stage. And so that it just came naturally. I don't really know how to explain it. But it's been great, and I definitely want to get into doing more speeches as well as, poetry performances, musical performances, things of that nature.
Okay. So that's a good look. Definitely you're planning for the future, definitely. So
Yeah.
let's see. Wow, it's very I'm really enjoying the vibe here because I love to connect with people who are tangible. You know,
Yes.
you can definitely always support people who are doing things, who are moving, shaking things up, and really creating new doors and opportunities. But the power in having a voice is being able to connect with people across boundaries, across borders, across backgrounds that allow you to kind of center in and hone what makes you a unique individual, but what ties you into another person. And I think that's just a really powerful tool. So to kind of piggyback and go back on what you said, I mean, to realize that at a young age that you say, as in your own words, you liked the hearing your voice, but really you recognized you had a voice,
Ah,
and
that's a good point.
you recognized that you enjoyed sharing your voice, and you recognized that you got a reaction from what you shared, and whatever that reaction was, you embraced it, and it inspired you to want to move forward and do more. So I want to kind of transition a little bit and get into what we all know, if you're a creative or if you're not a creative, anyone who's chasing their passion or who has career goals, we know that it's a stepping stone. There are processes involved. And so comparing your early development to when you first realized that you had a voice and you first realized that you could inspire people, and then you get your first job, was it what you envisioned it to be? Did you love it? Did you hate it? What was that?
My first like real job, because coming from Queens, New York, everybody's a hustler. So I grew up admiring the hustler and just looking at how they spoke, how they sold a product, how they delivered the passion behind whatever they were doing, right? I love that passion. So I mean, my first job was, I would say, in middle school, I had a candy sale business. I would sell candy. Like when they give you the box and then
Right,
they tell
right.
you go sell it. I was selling them for two for a dollar, so I would sell like three boxes while people were still in their first. And then they told me I had to stop selling candy. So then I moved to like lanyards, like the little strings that, people used to play with back in middle school. I started selling those. So I was always kind of like an entrepreneur, had little side gigs on the end. But I think when I turned about 15, 16, I worked at like a plastic distribution company in Connecticut. So that was my first like actual job. Like I got a paycheck. It was great. Making about $12 an hour, I think. So, and this was a
So it was
couple of
good
years
money. First
ago.
job, good money.
It was really good. And so I did, I mean I don't I it was a commute, right? Because I was actually still staying in Queens, but I would commute to Connecticut kind of like every week to go to work. And so it was interesting for me. I loved actually getting the paycheck, doing the work, and I got to see how business actually worked. At that point, it was the first time I had ever been in like an office, right?
Right.
So it was good. I would say it was a good experience. I got to see how business worked. I got a paycheck,
And that's
and I just
powerful.
understood a lot more. Yeah.
That's a powerful part of the process and the progress, because I think a lot of times young people are people early on in business entrepreneurship, they forget that it's a process. And the stepping stones are very real. You still have what you're accountable for on the back end as far as your personal bills, what it takes to pursue your passions and your talents. But it definitely it takes character. It takes character to recognize that you do need a job, and that you don't let the job define you, but you define the job by what you can bring to the table, So it's all about that acquiring skills and transferable skills. That's what I like to call them. I love talking to entrepreneurs because they understand the power of transferable skill sets.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about, and that's what I took from it. A lot of people, grow up in these communities, urban communities and they look at the hustlers and they want to be exactly like them. But me, I was able to kind of extract like the best qualities from them. And that's why, I always say I'm a hustler. Like, I don't think, to be a hustler, like, you have to sell narcotics or anything. That's like being a drug dealer. But to be a hustler, you can sell anything, And so I just always loved that about them. So yeah, it's definitely taking the best qualities from them.
Yeah, the term hustler is definitely a part of the American culture. It's, there are whole shows dedicated to it. You have the American hustler, you have, the hustler, or AKA known as the hustle and bustle, really, to kind of describe the everyday kind of working American, the person working to accomplish their dream. Definitely it's a grind. And it's a word that embodies all of that, the process, the journey, the mindset, the ambition, the goals, the determination, the struggle. So it's definitely something that I'm sure our audience appreciates because we understand that term very fully.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
And it's great that, we can speak with someone on the show, on the blog Music Art Culture, who has an understanding of it as well. So we definitely appreciate your honesty and your awareness of the culture and things that we understand. So all right, so how do you balance career and family?
Good one. I would say it's definitely tough. I mean, I don't even think I'm that busy yet, as how busy I can get. But I think, it's really just remembering, those important people, and if they're important to you, you'll make time. And so, a lot of times I catch myself working, working, working. I'm like, wait a minute, I gotta stop. Let me take my mom to Cheesecake Factory, and so I think it's really just remembering the people that are important, and sometimes taking that break allows you to recharge and get more inspiration, because I mean, that's who we do it for, is our family. So I would say it's tough, but I would say the way to kind of balance it is just taking a break sometimes, right? Telling yourself you need a break, or even setting that in your schedule if you're kind of type A to that point where you have to move by your schedule, like just put it in your schedule and definitely take a break. Yeah.
All right, now what was taking that insight, taking those knowledge nuggets, and let's just put it into perspective. What was a defining point in your life that gave you courage to branch out as an entrepreneur? And while you were doing all of that, how did you juggle everything when it came to family, personal relationships, friends?
Yeah, I would say the thing that kind of, gave me that spark was, I had a job fairly recently, and we would work until about 2 a.m. in the morning sometimes, and this didn't make sense to me. It was just like, why would anybody actually sign up to do this job, to work this hard from 9 a.m. until 2 a.m. for months, right? And so I had always been an entrepreneur, but I guess in this sense of kind of founding Boardhouse and other ventures, it was kind of that it was just like, whoa, I don't ever want to do this again. I don't want anyone to ever tell me I have to work till 2 a.m. right? And it was just more so free. It was more so freedom, right? So having being told you have to stay here or be fired, like that ultimatum didn't make any sense to me. And so it was just having the freedom to do what I want, go where I want, purchase what I want, and be around the people that I wanted to be with, like my family and friends. That was kind of the spark behind everything. That's why we do everything. And so that was really it. I had a job that I hated. I was just like, you know what? It's time to actually go to my secret plan, and then, this is what happened.
All right. I feel that. The secret plan, the secret place. You have to strategize. That's what it's all about. And that's a really good note that you tap into there. It's about having a plan, deciding what works best for you and what you're trying to accomplish, and then figuring out a way to strategize how to streamline that without causing any major disruption.
Yeah, definitely.
Because the wheels still have to keep going, right? I mean, you still have to hit your bottom line. You still have to do everything you need to do, show up for the people you need to show up for. And then in the middle of all of that, you still have to show up for yourself and be present. So it is a juggling act. And I think a lot of up-and-coming entrepreneurs or people who are already established like yourself, who have a publishing house, who have a book out, who are actively doing things and working with other people, there are stages and levels, and you do have to kind of see ahead of it, but also live in the midst of it to stay grounded, to actually get some roots in, get a strong foundation so that you can kind of step up to the next level. So love your perspective on that. Now, what inspired you to start your publishing house? How did that come about? First off, what inspired the name?
So what inspired the name Board House? So in Trinidad, my grandmother grew up in on the island, we call this a board house. It's kind of like a wooden shack almost.
Okay.
If you kind of think about like a wooden shack, and back in those days, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, my grandmother raised my aunts and uncle in this board house. And, you know, there were stories about they didn't have like electricity, and this is way back, right? So they didn't have electricity. They didn't have, you know, sometimes water, heat, things like that, right? And so the way they would entertain themselves is by sitting around sometimes and telling stories to each other, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was this really intimate setting where it was really humble. They didn't have a lot, but they had each other and they had stories. And sometimes, especially in 2018, like we don't even talk to each other. Like we're constantly on our cell phones. But imagine if we got, you know, all the people we loved, and if we were able to do this, like imagine if it was Thanksgiving every night. We got everybody we loved around the table, it wasn't tables back then. So imagine just sitting around on the floor, telling stories, sharing stories, laughing. It was this really intimate setting I wanted to recreate. And that's kind of the energy that I founded Board House with. And ultimately my grandmother took that board house and turned it into two-story homes. In Trinidad. So it's like, it's just like, how do you go from that to this, right? And so it's that mentality. It's like, okay, yeah, we'll have this intimate experience. We'll be humble, but just know like the mansions are coming, the bestsellers are coming, and they already came, but you know, like all of this is coming, but let's just start on the groundwork. Let's tell these stories that are hard to tell. And so that was the idea and energy and drive behind Board House. Yeah.
Wow, how inspirational. So it went from like a one shack situation to a two-story?
Yeah, two of them, two-story homes. So
wow.
Like, it's just like, how does that happen, right? Like, typically, like, that person isn't supposed to have that, you know? The story doesn't always happen like that. So it's just miraculous that she was able to do that, you know?
Vision. It's all in the vision.
Yeah.
It's all in the vision. Okay. Woo. Wow.
And what,
so
what,
yeah, definitely you come from a good place, sir.
Yeah,
strong
definitely.
Strong roots,
you know,
in the ground. Talk about foundations.
Very
that
strong
is
roots.
Definitely a great building point to have those kind of influences in your life. So
yeah,
okay. So how do you feel about these up and coming generations, these younger millennials, younger generations? Do you feel that they struggle more with bullying, body image, and identity than their parents or older generations did?
I mean, I think, yeah, you know, because of social media, really, is we're just gonna blame it on social media. So I would say yes, they definitely do, because you know now they're comparing likes and they're comparing comments and they're comparing followers, and then they got this person doesn't like them, this person doesn't want to go out, and they can see all of this in real time. Or you know, they can't look like this celebrity, you know, or they want to look like this person. So I think it's a lot worse. Dealing with millennials than their parents had it. Yeah,
and that's so true. It's like social media has really evolved the way that we interact and view each other. But, you know, there's always that silver lining, too, because it definitely has the potential to always bring people together. But it can be a little bit, it can throw a wrench in somebody's self-esteem if they're not careful, because when you think about it, just what you were touching on as far as your grandmother and what she was able to do in such a short time span, the amount of focus and drive that comes with that, you know, everybody has to be on the same page. You definitely have to have a team. You have to know where you're going. You have to have a vision. And it's so true. It's these younger kids, they struggle a lot. Nothing new is under the sun, but it's kind of tricky to navigate because, you know, the variables are different. So it's easy to always feel like maybe somebody a little older than you doesn't or can't relate because
they don't have as many, you know, this Instagram or this social media platform or, you know, but at the end of the day, the struggles are the same. And I think that, you know, that's a good point that you touch on. So, yeah, it's crazy how much things have changed. But what advice would you give for young people who are trying to find their voice as writers?
I would say have a stance, you know. You have to stand for something. And so, you know, if you do it for everybody, you're doing it for nobody. So have a stance, have an audience who you want to talk to and speak to that audience, and don't worry about, you know, the majority audience or whoever it is. You know, if that's your audience, speak to them and do it for them. Do it for yourself first. Like, be happy with whatever you do first, but speak to your audience and cater to them. Like, really cater to your audience. They'll reward you. You know, so really have a target audience. And I would say kind of, you know, I would say a great writer, right, knows a lot about their target market. A great writer will know kind of how their target market will respond to certain phrases, certain scenarios in their passage, in their book, and certain climaxes. And I think a great writer knows how to phrase things to get a rise out of their audience and keep their audience engaged. And I think that would actually make a great writer, knowing how to do those things. But you have to know who you're doing it for. You have to take a stance.
Great advice. Take a stance. Great writers take a stance and they know who they're doing it for. They know who they're talking to. They know who they're connecting with. They've identified that person and who they are in that journey to actually connect.
Most definitely.
Wow. Do you do any mentoring? Do you provide mentoring to young writers or?
Yeah, definitely. You know, just last week, actually, and me, you know, being a poet and an author, I get to work with different individuals who want to perform, who, you know, have to work on their oration skills. And so just last week I had one of my mentees, he had a performance at this art show, and so, you know, he pulled me backstage and we were just kind of going over his poems before he went on, and there were different things that we had to work on, but, you know, he was able to kind of adapt really quickly with my suggestions, and he did really well at the show. And I think just anyone, you know, if they need coaching or things like that, you know, I'm always open to, you know, coaching as well in terms of writing, or if you're a poet, you know, helping you perform better, right? I'm a slam poet, so performance is everything. And I definitely, you know, mentor. But that moment last week was just, it was one of those moments where it's like, wow, this is what I can do for someone. This is what I mean to someone else, right? You don't really know your own kind of like hype or power until someone is just like, powerful. You know, Brandon, help me. And it's just like, you see how transformative that is in their life. And you're like, wow, I like this. Let me keep doing it, you know?
And I commend you too, because I think that's an awesome skill to be able to feed back into what's feeding you. You know, it's amazing that you have a passion for poetry. You have a passion for just educating publics and peoples and letting them know about your world and your perspective and getting tangible information out to them that helps them to grow and utilize some of the skills that you've acquired over time. But the ability that you have to actually feed into someone else who's doing the same thing speaks volume to your level of maturity and your willingness to not just evolve as a creator, but also support and evolve with those within your craft. And that's just a really great tool for others out there listening. If you have something that you're passionate about, you should always look into mentoring, because it definitely opens the door for others just to, you know, get a second opinion, get that perspective, get that feedback about the body of work that they're putting together and how it can connect or should connect with other people. So definitely, you know, that's a great process to be involved in, mentoring. So when it comes to mentoring, when it comes to looking at book submissions, when it comes to working with other writers, I know that it can be challenging because even though you're a creative, you're also in a position that allows you a lot of control. You know, you're the founder of a book publishing house. So, of course, no one likes to hear that they don't have a great body of work, but it happens sometimes. So have you ever had to reject a book submission?
Yeah, I would say, there's some stories. I would say there was one iteration where someone sent me a book and it was just grammatically just all over the place. The story just didn't make sense. And, you know, the topic they were speaking about, it wasn't something that I would personally publish. It wasn't something I would stand behind, right? And if I can't stand behind it, if I don't actually feel it, we're definitely not gonna, put it out, because it doesn't really have that striking feel to it. And I would say kind of like the story, it was really, the topic was, you know, just all over the place. It wasn't really a good topic to discuss. I don't want to share too much. It was just a lot.
No direction. So, it wasn't going in. It wasn't a whole vision of a unified idea that people would get.
Yeah,
does that
yeah,
kind of
well,
sum it up, or
to say the least? Yeah, and I would say overall, you know, we've denied books where the author didn't really believe in themselves, like, or they didn't have a vision, right? So we would get on the phone and they'd be like, "We just want to publish the book." And at Board House, that's not really what we do. At Board House Publishing, we like to take it further. Like, if you don't have kind of like a 3 to 5 year plan of what you want to do as an author, and how you want to grow your audience, how you want to, you know, take this book. If you're not trying to go speak in like Egypt or something, like, we're not really trying to work with you. Like, if you just want a book to just show to your family and friends, you know, that's not something that I can work on, because you don't believe in yourself that you can take this further as far as you want, and so I can't take it, you know, any further than you think you can take it, right?
And that's a good point. Yeah. And a lot of people forget about that when they're in this creative process. When you're looking to partner, anybody listening out there, if you're interested in you know, getting feedback, this is definitely a person, a voice that you want to pay attention to, because you just put it out there so plainly. If you have no vision for your own work, it's very hard for people to get behind you, to back you, to support that work.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, you know, we're definitely not just putting out books for your family. you know, like,
you're looking
we're
to
not,
make an impact in the literary world and not just fill it with words.
Exactly.
So
like, it's about the impact. Like, you have, this has to touch someone, and you have to tell us why you think it would touch someone. So that's often one of the questions I ask is, you know, I often say, like, why are you writing this book? Like, why does the world need to see this? And if they can't answer that question, you know, it's an automatic, it's just a dub, you know, it's a wrap. And we let them know that, you know, it's a passion thing, right? We definitely, and in that case, I think that's a mentoring moment too, where it's just like, we mentor them on how to kind of have more passion behind it. Like, this is why we're not going to accept it. It's not because the book isn't well written, it's just because you don't believe in it, you know. Like, I can't believe in it more than you do. So
it,
you know,
is a process. You look, yeah, at the submission, you do take it in for what it is. If there's interest, you offer mentoring. It's just not a blatant reject where you're like, no, we don't want this. You take a look at it, you see where the author's head is at, and if it's something that you at least can find a glimmer of, you know, dedication and inspiration, you try and bring that out of the author, or what I call them, artist.
Yeah, most definitely. We try to help as many people as we can, but you got to help yourself first, for sure.
Definitely. A great point. You have to be self-motivated in the game of life. Great point.
Hey, that's a bar.
So how, in your opinion, how many rewrites should a body of work undergo before it's actually ready to be published?
I would say typically, you know, that answer is real, so this is going to be real subjective, but I think typically 3, and then after that, it's just really, do you feel comfortable with it? I think that's a, a great point. Once again, you have to feel comfortable. You have to say, you know what, even if it isn't perfect, this is what I'm giving the world, and this is what they're going to get. And I'm just going to believe in it so much. I'm going to push it so much that they're going to love it too. But you have to feel comfortable. So, I mean, grammatically, just to catch most errors, I would say it might take 3 to 4 times. But then after that, it's you know, when are you ready? Do you feel like this is it? And how do you feel? And are you comfortable with the world reading it like this?
And that's a good point. How are you comfortable with it? And then also, I think there's power in the ability to do the rewrite too, because it's you're dedicated to the idea that it can always be better than what it already is. And I know that you've had to like run into writers who probably struggle with the rewrite, like the idea that it's not perfect and they have to do a rewrite. I mean, what's your approach? How do you keep them inspired to keep going without just, you know, crumbling the wall?
I think most times the authors that we work with are very motivated. So they do their thing. It'll be like 2 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, they're calling my phone, and you know, it's just like
nonstop.
But that's what we want. We want someone who's just energized. So most times they get it done on their own. But sometimes when they're not, you know, we just have to really remind them why they told us that they're doing this, right? Like we have to remind them of their purpose. Sometimes you forget that once you get kind of bogged down in the trenches, it's easy to forget why you're doing it. And so we kind of come in at a high level and say, all right, this is why you're doing it. 3 to 5 years, you want this. This is the change you want to see. These are the people you want to impact. This book is going to get you to make that impact. And so we kind of reverse engineer their thought process to get them back on track.
Definitely, definitely. So what are the top 3 skills for a successful author? What would you consider the top 3?
Passion, pleasure, and purpose.
Passion, pleasure, and purpose. I think that solidifies it. That's like 360 right there.
Drop the mic.
Yes, passion, pleasure, and purpose. Yes, we're definitely going to hashtag those. And Brandon Alexander said it best. That's what you need. That's what it takes. Yes, I agree with that. So what inspires you to keep going on this journey of writing, opening doors, and creating opportunities for others in the literary world?
I would say I'm very inspired by Jay-Z. So it's kind of, you know, when I wrote my first book, The Winter's Cactus, it was more so, okay, I'm going to write this book, but now I need a publisher. Then I was like, okay, Brandon, well, we've seen that before, right? So, all right, create the publishing house. Like, like it was all kind of based around ownership and then teaching other people how to own their work and build on from that. So that's really what it's around. It's like 10 years from now, we want this Black encyclopedia of just literature. We want them to say like, oh, if you need, you know, this author, go to Board House because they have work featuring this author, this brand of author, right? So that's really what keeps me going. It's a vision of saying, you know, this is the central database for all things Black, you know, all things for the struggle, for the people. And I think there was a quote I heard one time that said, you know, until the lions learn to tell the story, until the lions learn to write, the hunters are always going to tell the story. And so that's why we're doing it. We're being a resource. We're teaching people. Like I said, this world is so digital that, you know, a lot of people forgot about the books. But now we're seeing, you know, a resurgence of kind of that literary bug, you can imagine. So my whole thing is just ownership, being a resource to people who want to get their work out, and just ownership, right? Teaching you how to own your own work. And we're a lot different from a lot of publishing companies. You know, the incumbent large publishing houses, they take, you know, a majority of your royalties, and we're not really doing that. You know, we're actually teaching you how to own your own work, your literary rights, your IP, everything like that. We're actually marketing the book for you as well. That's another thing large publishing houses aren't doing. And so another thing, when I wrote my first book, I didn't have any help. And so I wanted to create a company based around, you know, young authors that don't necessarily have access to these larger publishers, for young authors who don't have access to a ton of capital and a huge marketing budget. You know, so I pretty much built the company around everything I didn't have. So we added marketing, we added business consulting, we added intellectual property, coaching, different things like that, and teaching you how to own your work. So everyone we work with, they actually own their own work. And we're not taking huge percentages of their royalties at all. So it's created for authors by authors. And I think that's kind of what really motivates me to keep going is the ownership factor for yourselves, for myself, for everyone. Like, we can own what we do and have this huge encyclopedia at the end of the day.
And that's a powerful talking point as well, because there aren't a lot of resources out there who are wanting to take in artists, authors, and also educate them. Because when you talk about ownership, that's a powerful tool. When you talk about royalties and things like that, that's a powerful tool. And I think a lot of times people, they get very excited, very zealous about opportunities, but they don't necessarily do their homework, and they get into these really bad back-end deals to where maybe, you know, the royalties aren't that great for various reasons. Maybe the book just isn't selling, or maybe they just did a bad deal. But because of lack of, you know, information or communication, you know, they're locked into a deal for years on end, and they don't have any idea of how to actually continue to put out great work and survive off their work, or have control over their work, as you're saying. And those intellectual properties, those creative boundaries in business are really important. And it's great to know that you're actually opening doors to make sure that your clients, your people under your publishing house are having these full conversations and having a vast understanding of not just what you provide, but also what will be covered in the type of deals that they do with Boardhouse Publishing.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, it's all about ownership and control, and that's another thing. It's just like we literally work with you to help you, you know, control your work and where it's going and everything like that. So it's not like, you know, we'll publish it and you'll see a cover and you're like, wait a minute, I didn't see this before it came out, or I didn't help create this cover. It's really just all in your hands, and we're just helping you do it as well. And that's the, you know, that's why it's really cool that we're the size we are right now. We're able to like make this a real personable experience.
So everything is in-house when it comes to the art direction, when it comes to the management. You help them from A to Z.
A to Z, yeah. We do the publishing, we do management, and we're gonna jump into entertainment a little while down the road. You gotta see that as well. But it's all for authors, it's all for the creative, it's all for the poets. You know, and we do nonfiction and fiction as well. But we're focused on poetry right now, focused on the voices, and it's, you know, it's A to Z, full service.
Definitely important for the creative community to know. So thank you so much. And you know, I really have to give you a shout out here, because initially I was looking at the Instagram page for Boardhouse Publishing, and I can say it was very clean, very clear messages of inspiration that just really taps directly into people. And it's like you're inspiring them to put their work out there. You're inspiring them to be informed about you know, their craft and everything that it entails. And your page is very welcoming. And so, you know, I just wanted to give you your props for that. Shout out to that, Boardhouse Publishing. Also, you provide a link on your IG page for a free ebook. And it's talk a little bit about that. It was like the top 10 steps
Oh
to.
yeah, so it's called the 10 hacks to publishing your book in 60 days. It's kind of like a step-by-step guide for the first-time author. And in there, you know, I threw together 10 little points of things to really keep you on track, right? Like creating a schedule, editing your book, finding a publisher. I kind of break down the difference in publishers between like traditional self-publishing and a hybrid publisher. So there's a ton of just quick information in there to keep you on track to really getting your book out. And it was really good, because I remember my first book, it actually took me 3 years to write it. You know, but it didn't have to take that long. I just wasn't dedicated to it. And so I would, you know, start it, put it down, start it, you know, put it down like nobody's gonna read this. So I created, you know, the 10 hacks book just to really get, you know, authors or people thinking about being authors to really get engaged with their craft and stick to it, create a schedule and let them know like all the little bumps in the roads that are going to come to them and but
Right.
how good it can be on the back end. So that's a quick read. You know, it's not long at all, but it's very informative. So you guys can grab that ASAP on our Instagram. It's Boardhouse, Board House underscore publishing on Instagram. Feel free to download that book ASAP.
Yes. And I love it. I love how you're open about the process and how that actually was the foundation for the ebook, keeping
Yes.
people on schedule, keeping people, informed, because I mean, totally, you can obviously, what I've gathered from this is you got things going on from, every direction. It takes a lot to write. It takes a lot to, now you're publishing and then, you do the slam poetry and you're constantly connecting with people. So you hold a lot of hats, but in that process, you're like, you know what? Let me make sure they know. And I totally love that it's a great resource, again, for aspiring authors out there, writers out there who are looking for a direction to take those stepping stones or those steps on how to be heard and how to actually get themselves ready to pitch themselves. So for any of you out there listening, hey, you got a book, you got, a book of poems, you have a novel that you're working on, and you're trying to figure out how to even hold a conversation, how to even approach a publishing house, head over to Board Publishing. They definitely want to help you. They have some great people there to be a resource to you over at Board House Publishing. And definitely, you hear how informed the founder is, so you know that you'll be in good hands. FYI, something to take in. Don't overlook the wisdom, people, because everyone does not give it. So, last question, and this is our fun question. I always like to ask because you never know what you're going to get, and it's just so much fun. If you could be an animal, what animal would you be and why?
Oh man, wow, okay. Didn't know this was coming. I would say, I would probably be a wolf.
Ooh,
Always,
okay.
yeah, I always loved wolves. And I think why? Because you know they hunt in packs. And you can't really do anything by yourself. In this life, like you like I'm really dependent on other people. You know, and it takes a lot to
Yes.
admit that, but it's very true. I think, you know, we're more dependent on people than we you know, acknowledge. And so I think the entire pack mindset is just like you can't eat literally without other people. And so I need y'all, you know, I need my team. I need you, Dominique, to get this episode out right. Like we need each other to
Right.
work together. That's just how the world works. You know, shutting ourselves away isn't really how things happen best. So I'm just a wolf, you know, just hunting, but you know, ready to go down for the pack at all costs, you know. So it's
Down for
all
the
for one and one
squad.
for all. Yeah.
I love
Yeah.
that. I love that. Oh my gosh, gems, gems. The wolf is your animal, but I love the reason behind it. You follow in packs, you need other people, and it's a lot. It thumbs up culture as a whole. It totally sums up culture as a whole. Wow. Gems
Most
of
definitely.
inspiration. Run with the pack, find your voice, make your identity accessible, be connected with your community, be willing to go outside your comfort zone, and always be willing to do the hard work. Such a great interview. Thank you so much, Brandon Alexander, for taking time out of your busy schedule to have this conversation with me for the Blog Music Art Culture. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your willingness to just be transparent and connect with people through your passion. And again, tell us your book of poems that's out now and how the people can get that.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so it's called The Winter's Cactus. It's an autobiographical collection of poetry. You guys can find that at thewinterscactus.com. or you can go to Amazon, download it. So between, you know, Amazon or thewinterscactus.com. At thewinterscactus.com, you can actually get exclusive merchandise as well and a signed copy by me as well. You can't get that on Amazon. So we got exclusive, exclusive-ish going down on thewinterscactus.com. And you can follow me on Instagram at, you know, underscore Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N, Alexander, and then underscore. And you can also follow the company, Board House Publishing, at Board House, B-O-A-R-D, House, underscore Publishing, on the gram. Let's get it.
And I love that. Don't overlook that, people. Go straight, direct to the website, because he did mention merch. And hey, you know what? It's always how it starts. You get those budding, those right on the cusp, and then you're going to regret if you don't get that signed copy, you know?
Mm-hmm. The winter's coming. I mean, you know, you got to be the winter's cactus, survive the storm.
There you go. Run with the wolves. Run with the wolves, because we definitely need the pack. Thank you for your contribution, and thank you for joining us here on the blog Music Art Culture. I am your host, Dominique, and again, we have Brandon Alexander here for Board House Publishing. Stay tuned till next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Dominique.
Thank you for listening to the blog Music Art Culture. For more info on today's guest, go to musicartculture.org. Click the contact page and send us an email. Until next time.